travelers, and welcome to the Traversing the Stars podcast. Today's special guests are Eric and Julia Lewald. You know them as the writers behind X-Men, the animated series cartoon from the 1990s. Now come join us as we go traversing the stars.
Hello, and welcome to the show, Eric and Julia. Sorry about that. How are you guys doing today?
Great, Jaden. Thanks for having us on.
Yes, thank you so much.
Yeah, not a problem. It's honestly, the honor is ours. So listen, I just wanted to ask you guys a quick question. How and when did you two meet? Just for the books.
I'm pointing behind us here because we have some art up. We met at Disney TV Animation back in what I consider the golden days when it was just getting started. Back in 1988, I was lucky enough to get hired on as a writer for Chippendale's Rescue Rangers, and you were already working there in the office next door, and you were writing the same, we were both script writers, and that's how we met.
Yep, offices next door, the office romance bit, so it worked out, it was a wonderful place to work. I'd been about 4 years in the business. I'd been on staff at Hanna-Barbera, a couple other places, and I'd moved to Disney in late 87, and then she came on as
fellow writer.
Yeah, on Rescue Rangers. And I bailed for about 6 months to go work on a movie, but I came back and, you know, we started going out and soon we're engaged and married. So
let me say we were equals in the office. I wasn't his superior, he wasn't mine. It wasn't one of those awkward things. Fully consensual.
I didn't force her to marry me.
And vice versa.
No script assignments for you.
Well, I want to say that's a perfect Disney story to have started in Disney. You should actually talk to them about making that the movie.
But so we got to work on the Disney afternoon. Chippendale's Rescue Rangers.
Darkwing Duck, Winnie the Pooh, DuckTales.
Goof Troop.
Gummy Bears. All the they had like six or seven different series going, all like 65 episode orders. And that was one of the reasons that we both got into the business in the late 80s is that there was a sudden boom. I got on Hanna-Barbera January 85 because they suddenly had two or three syndicated shows and they'd need 65 episodes instead of 13. And my neighbor was working there and he said, look, I know you're writing and you're looking for, you know, places to fit in here in television, but, you know, we are hiring. I mean, we suddenly, you know, tripled our order over at HB. So at least come by. And so that's that era of cartoons is what got us both in the door, the demand at that time.
Right. Yeah, so I guess now that we're kind of talking about, you know, your first initial experiences like in the industry and, you know, being in entertainment and, you know, with movies and stuff, did you always know like this is what you wanted to do, or was it something that you kind of gradually, as you got older, it became, you know, something that you were interested in?
I think one of the things we found out about each other early on is we each came to California from very otherworldly places. I grew up in Texas and never occurred to me that you could move to California and work in the entertainment industry until one day in college when it did. And that flipped it for me. That's like, you can move, you can go there. I'll say this too. It took me 10 years to get a break. Once I got here, I took 10 long years thinking that was before the internet age. Mm-hmm. It was a hard slog sort of crafting my way into it. Took 3 years, became a lawyer, practiced law, but that was all in service of trying to crack the industry as a writer of anything. I didn't care. I was happy to be offered any opportunity to pounce on.
Yeah, it's a very strange place out here. It's like, I grew up in East Tennessee. It's like wanting to work designing cars. If you want to be a TV movie writer, and let's just, if you want to design cars, you go to Detroit and you knock on Ford's door and say, I really like cars. Can I design the next Mustang, please? Right. Well, no, there's like 400,000 people in Detroit ahead of you. And you have to figure out how they got their jobs and how you will fit into this very, very strange world out here. Mm-hmm. And I loved movies. I programmed them in college, made a low budget movie coming out of college and sold it. Back when there were drive-in movies and you could make a movie on the cheap. So came out here with a partner in my early 20s, couldn't, you know, had no clue how to break in.
Right.
But it, and literally the reason that I'm in animation rather than something else was my neighbor was on staff at Hanna-Barbera. And if he'd been on staff on a sitcom, I probably would have got in on a sitcom and would have now 35 years of sitcom work behind me. It's I wasn't planning. I mean, I loved like Warner Brothers animation and an early 30s Popeyes and 1940 Superman, and, you know, old Fleischer cartoons, loved old theatrical cartoons and Bullwinkle, which I thought was brilliantly funny. But for the most part, you know, I didn't grow up like so many of the people that we knew at Disney loving animation for animation's sake. And that was mostly the artists that did. We just loved storytelling. And it happened that this was the corner I fell into. And one of the real benefits of it was, is that it kind of lets you do a lot more filmmaking in your head when you're writing. In a sitcom, you're basically just handing dialogue to the director, and the director and the actors block everything out and revise everything 15 times. When we're writing animation scripts, they're much longer and more detailed because we're trying to detail to the artists, what are you going to storyboard? You know, who's going to be in the frame? You know, where is it moving to? That kind of filmmaking in your head, which I really enjoy when I'm writing, you just can't do in primetime television. But in animation, the artists actually appreciate it, that you've taken the time. You didn't just say, X-Men have a big fight in Manhattan.
Right. Yeah.
Period. Figure this out. you give them something to work with. And that's been really, really a fun part of the filmmaking in your head part has been a fun part of writing for animation.
So I have a question for Julia, actually. Quite often in the world of animation, it tends to be very a male dominated industry. As a female, how difficult was for you to break in? And did you find that there were certain projects that they said or felt or seemed to feel that a female writer wasn't supposed to write for in the world of animation?
Of course. I don't mean of course, but yes. The short answer is yes. And here we are in the year 2022, and it's very gratifying to see that some of the barriers, if they're not coming down, at least they're being discussed. At least they're being explored. There is literally no difference between an artist who can pick up a pen and pencil and a writer who can pick up a pen and pencil and the putting of the words or the art on the page. It's the same skill set. There's no gender issue, but on the production executive side, things get so narrowly focused. Is this show for preschool? Well, is it for 2 to 3 year olds? Is it for 4 to 6 year olds? Is it boys action adventure? Is it girls fantasy? I mean, the folks on the executive side get very concerned about the product is going to be.
The category was called throughout most of our career, boys action adventure. Mm-hmm. X-Men wasn't action adventure. It was boys action adventure. And in most of those shows before X-Men, it was maybe 85, 15, 90, 10, the viewing audience the advertisers would count on that. The investors would count on that. And when we did the X-Men, first of all, our main boss was a woman.
The president of Fox.
Who had pushed for this and who's the whole reason the show got on the air. And she absolutely believes, look, there's so many strong female characters in X-Men that the girls are going to love this. They're going to aspire to be an X-Men, not, you know, they're not going to drift through while their brother is watching this. They're going to sit down and watch this, and mm-hmm. you're going to double your audience. Nobody heard her. You know, they wouldn't listen. For 10 years, she tried to pitch the show. Nobody would buy it. So finally she gets in as head of her own kids department, said, we're doing this one first and you just watch. And it was true. It was almost 50-50 audience, maybe, you know, 60-40 instead of 90-10, because half the X-Men were kick-ass women. And some of the strongest ones were kick-ass women. Mm-hmm. And you wouldn't believe the number of women, adult women we've now said, you don't understand. When I was 10 and I got to watch Storm be that heroic, I got to watch Rogue be that heroic, or Jean, it just, I couldn't find it anywhere else on television. And I just was glued to it. So we didn't do it on purpose. You know, we just looked at the books and thought, well, these are the most interesting characters we could put together as a team. And it happened to be half and half. But in other shows, we've really been told, oh, well, what you need is like six guys and a girl, which we refer to as the Smurfette. You know, you need six X-Men and a Smurfette to, you know, get them coffee. And even after X-Men, we would get a job assignment and they'd look at our development and say, oh, you got too many women in this group.
Yeah.
It needs to be 80-20 or 90-10.
Yeah.
And it hadn't gotten through yet. And so, yeah, I'm sure it's much less of a deal in 2022, but it was a serious deal when we were doing it.
And, you know, I think that's really impressive because it's the audience being that close, male, female, for the X-Men cartoon, X-Men comic books in the world of comic books is so more extreme. I mean, it's almost, I'm guessing, almost 80-20 in the comic book industry. So the fact that you were able to get the cartoon to be that, to keep those demographics that close to 50-50 is really a testament to how well you guys did in keeping the female audience and getting them engaged in the world of X-Men.
There was no reason not to assume that the female audience was there for this kind of adventure, but it had been so, dare I say it, baked into the industry. There are so many gatekeepers on the executive production side of things that Eric mentioned, Margaret Lesh, the president of Fox Kids. She's the reason we have Batman the Animated Series, that we have X-Men, that we have The Tick, that we have all the shows on Fox Kids Saturday morning that really were game changers. And she herself had come from Marvel Productions when it was a small little satellite office out here in Los Angeles. It was producing, wasn't it, doing Spider-Man and the Muppets? It was producing things.
It was producing things like Muppet Babies and Transformers, but they couldn't sell a Marvel show, which is very frustrating if you're Marvel Productions and you have to try to explain to your bosses or your colleagues back at the comic book. Nobody in Hollywood thinks there's a market for superhero comic book TV shows. They just don't think it'll work. They think there's this little corner. Margaret was constantly told there's this tiny little corner of, you know, pimply guys in their basements with their comic books. They'll watch, but we need five times that. And there's just not comic books don't translate to television and movies.
Batman had had its success and, you know, it had a few movies, had the 66 TV show.
But that's like one thing every decade.
Superman had a movie every decade. Spider-Man had an animated series. You know, we all can sing the theme song. But go back in time in 1992, the vast majority of the country had never heard of the X-Men. So that was an uphill slog right there.
Yeah, that's, which is an odd thing to imagine now. The first note we got from her when we started out, you got to understand 85% of the people we're trying to reach on Saturday morning will not have heard of the X-Men, will not know what they are, will not know what this world is.
You got to
introduce all the whole thing about mutancy and powers and who they are and what they feel about each other. You have to take your time to set this up because they're just not part of the popular culture. They're central to the comic culture, but again, that's 5% of America. We need it to be 30% of America and end up being 60-90% of America, but at the time it just wasn't. And that's just, I can't even imagine it now. It's like there was no internet. How can you imagine working without the internet? And at the time there just wasn't, you know. We faxed stuff to each other.
So Julian,
so I guess with the X-Men talk and, you know, with the translating everything from the comics and, you know, making the screen rendition of that, were you guys comic fans prior to all of you know, whatever you had going on with X-Men and starting those series?
Artists were in our group. The artists knew these books backward and forward.
That's Will Mineo, Larry Houston as a character design, art, producer directors on the art side of the show.
Yeah.
Rick Hoberg, other folks on the art side.
Yeah, on the animation side. They were, I'd read some comics when I was younger, which would have been like mid 60s. But really, I didn't know him very well. About half the writers knew some of the books. The writers was very much like whoever was available, and there's no writers' room. There's no staff. They wouldn't give us money for anything continuous. It was just like, okay, here's a little bit of money for each episode. Hire who you want, but it's just one-offs. So you know, I hired the best animation writers I knew, and about half of them knew comics. The other half didn't know them at all, and I really barely knew. I mean, I didn't know really who the X-Men were. The night before I'm supposed to pitch this to Stan Lee and everybody, how perfect I am for the show, I'm on the phone calling friends saying, tell me about the X-Men. Because I really, it was not part of my back. I read Spider-Man and Fantastic Four and you know a few others, but it was not one of my books.
Right. That's actually interesting because the X-Men, the animated series, honestly set the groundwork for the success of Marvel's future. I would say that even before there was the animated series, there were live action, you know, Captain America movies. There was Doctor Strange, there was Spider-Man, but they didn't necessarily gain the popularity that X-Men did. Which I would like to say congratulations for, because that is not a very easy feat, especially in that day and age. But it was definitely something that set the groundwork for a lot of future success that Marvel now sees down the line.
Saying that, very much so. Thank you.
Yeah, of course. With that being said, would you consider after you know reaching that level of success? What were kind of your feelings towards, you know, Fox canceling it at, you know, after what, 76 episodes? I read somewhere that it was because they didn't like that Marvel was kind of controlling how they did things with their most popular series. But regardless of the reasoning, what were your guys' emotions towards that?
First thing, he was hired to develop the show, and I, along with the other writers, came on to do the individual scripts. It was only a 13 episode commitment. There was absolutely no confidence it would go beyond the first 13.
We were all let go after the first season, and we went out to work on other shows. Mm-hmm. Like I would work Exo Squad for three months while we were waiting to see if maybe the show would be successful when the animation got done.
And then it got picked up successfully for a second season, which was another 13 episodes, which still means, okay, in other words, none of us had a contract for 5 years from the beginning of the Enterprise. It wasn't until the third season that you got tapped to do what's considered a full order. 65 is considered a full series episode order.
Yeah.
So you were hired to finish that, which meant 2.5 years.
And so it was, obviously it was a shame we were where it was, but the best gig we ever had. It was great characters to write for. It was I know this sounds odd, but it was comfortably consistent work. We're all freelancers out here, and most everybody goes script to script or job to job, and having 76 paychecks in a row was a really great thing when we had two little kids, you know, to pay the mortgage. So on that part of it, we were used to shifting from show to show, either when we were in staff for a couple of years at Disney or Hanna-Barbera, or then once we got in the freelance world around 1990, you do the run of the show and then assume that you'd have to go out the next day and come up with some new business. So, you know, we've each worked on 40 some different series. So having one end was kind of the natural thing. Having one stretch out to 76 episodes was the outlier, was the exception.
Right.
Now, what could you always had about the X-Men? I grew up watching the X-Men cartoon. I'm in my 40s. So when X-Men cartoon, I was like about 12, 13 years ago, I was right at that right age for the cartoon. And by the way, and I loved it. It was one of those must-see shows. Was after Batman animated series, you know, watch the X-Men. One thing that I always wondered about, the show so often teased the introducing characters like Colossus, Nightcrawler, and all these characters that obviously they were, you thought they were about to join the team at the end of the episode, and obviously they didn't. Was there like some consideration somewhere that they're going to join the X-Men at some point down the line, or was it really concerned of you can only have so many voice actors that you had that a budget?
It was having so many characters to service. Yeah. You know, we speak of Batman, that's a very small cast, and it's Batman versus X-Men, where there's
like nine of them. And
per episode that need to be serviced or acknowledged or dealt with.
So it never occurred to us the first 4 years to, you know, episodes 1 through 65, that we're going to add anybody on, simply because it was overflowing as it was. And you find, you'll watch some of the shows, a bunch of them, it's just so hard to move 8 or 9 people around in a story that you just have 3 here, 2 here, and 3 here, or you just wouldn't see half the team for a story. And luckily audiences went with that, because it's just hard having that big a cast to deal with. Mm-hmm. Supposed to end it, there's going to be 65 episodes. They're going to end with Beyond Good and Evil,
a four-parter.
In fact, Fox, Sydney Iwanu, who's Margaret's right-hand man, said, well, you guys need to come up with a big thing to go out on a bang to end the series with. So we wrote this four-parter with the idea, with all sorts of stuff in the first couple episodes, where 4 or 5 of the X-Men will start, either if not dissatisfied, or they're starting to get distracted or had other concerns, wanted to get married, wanted to do whatever it was. By the end of the episode, 5 of them were going to leave and 4 new people were going to come on. And it was Bishop and Shard from the future who were going to be stuck here after this big time travel adventure, and Psylocke and Archangel. So those 4 were going to come on, and 5 of our current team were going to leave. But that was just going to be kind of our handshake. Goodbye, series is over. We didn't have any stories planned with the new team, but that was going to be a fun thing for the fans, saying, oh, cool, if they did another series, it'd be half a completely different team. Wouldn't that be fun? So we set that all up. We're going through it, and we get a phone call after we've written 160-page, 4-part script saying, oh, by the way, we need more episodes. We need 11, 5, and 6 more episodes with the original team. Cut out all the stuff about 5 people leaving and 4 people staying.
Okay. We still have that in a file cabinet.
We still have the story with them going and the other people staying in a file cabinet somewhere. But the point was, that was not. I mean, you have to be a professional. You have to say, okay, I understand. Somebody's ordered 11 more. We'll do this. But it was really disappointing, because we put a lot of effort in making it make sense and making the story work, that five of the X-Men are going to want to leave at one point, and now they didn't want to leave. And then why are Psylocke and these other people in the story now? Well, I don't know. but yeah, it was, we had planned to make a ship, but not to add on, to answer your question. I know it's one of these things, fans love all the characters. And when we looked at the original team, we looked from 1963 onwards in the books, and there were 29 different people up until that point that had been X-Men, and we thought, okay, who are the ones that complement each other best, that are different from each other to make the core 8 or so? But adding on more, there just wasn't room. Wasn't room at the end.
I just to get a real quick question in for, you know, we have the reboot coming. It's set to release in 2023. It's supposed to pick up from where the animated series in the 90s ended, hence the name 97. But what can you give us in terms of that show? And, you know, with I'm assuming Marvel reached out to you. I'm hearing you guys are some sort of consultants for the show, at the very least. What is there anything that you can give us in terms of, you know, without ruining any, you know, surprises or, you know, getting in trouble or anything like that?
You can be the first folks I try this out on. I wrote this today, so here we go.
Okay.
On November 12th, 2021, Disney Plus announced the production of X-Men 97. Together with original producer-director Larry Houston from X-Men the Animated Series, we have been brought on board as consulting producers. Beyond that, we have no comment.
I'm going to push for one question, though. Obviously, in 2000, the fan base who watched X-Men originally are now like me in their 40s. We're going to be the audience that's going to come back. I can guarantee to come back and watch X-Men 97 again. Right. Would the storylines reflect the fact that your audience is probably now much older than the ones that originally tuned
Beyond
in.
That, we have no comment.
Yeah. Okay, fair
just a general factual observation that will sustain your question. When we wrote this show, we were writing for Saturday morning children's show. Very, very strict rules about what you could show, what you couldn't show, what you could say. There's no blood. There's no guns. There's there's no sex. There's whatever it was. There are very serious limitations, and we pushed those boundaries more than anybody ever had previously for Saturday morning kids show. But it was still within that a Saturday morning kids show. The new show is going to be for Disney Plus.
But they're calling it X-Men 97. So you can take that for what it's worth for you, that X-Men the animated series ran from 92 to 97. This one is being called X-Men 97.
So
enjoy.
Right. So this question does kind of go back to the original. So you don't have to connect it to the new one, but so we can focus on the other one a little bit. Because you are dealing with characters that inherently have all powers that are extremely violent, laser eyes, claws, did that complicate matters in writing the original? And obviously, yeah. If you want to point out to Disney, whatever later, that's fine too.
it did. And there was one of the things that we, in general, we were able to set up exactly the world in the show that we wanted to. And Marvel was a very small company in New York doing comic books, and they really had, oddly, didn't have a say. They didn't have final say. Fox did. So if we made the show that Fox was happy with, even if Marvel didn't like it, which is so weird today. I mean, today, Marvel is like the largest creative force in the world, and they very much care about every detail about every show that they put out. Titan Marvel 92 didn't have that sort of sway with us. But interestingly, when we laid out the first season and we started with the Sentinels, which that was a very specific decision based on what you're talking about, because Wolverine was by far the most popular character in the X-Men. Mm-hmm. What does Wolverine have? He has these razor sharp claws. We couldn't ever have him cut anybody. Never once in 76 episodes does he stab or slice anybody, any person. Mm. But he ripped the living hell out of 800 robots. So we could have action against the Sentinels as a threat. But there was a voice from Marvel at the time that said, "What are you doing starting with the Sentinels? They're not half as important as Magneto in the history of X-Men. You really need to start with Magneto and have them fight Magneto and a bunch of Magneto's henchmen." And we just gently wrote back to the person, "Look, we'll get to Magneto in episode 3, we promise." Mm-hmm. He's going to be a big part of this. But for television, Wolverine will become a non-thing. You'll ruin your lead character if you can't have an adversary for him to slice up. And so that was the first, second, and third reason we chose the Sentinels, was so that Wolverine had something he could use his claws on. It was also great because it showed it was an embodiment of human fear and anger at mutants, at this small group of other that was different from them. And
that was
scaring
just born
them.
That way.
So here the Sentinels are a manifestation of this fear and hatred coming from people. So they're perfect for like five reasons, but we did get an early note saying, "Oh, you got to change it. You got to get rid of, you can't use the Sentinels to start off the series." And we fought, we pushed back and said, "Guys, you have your needs for the books. We have our needs for television. This fits, and it fits primarily because of Wolverine."
And by holding Magneto back until episode 3, it really allowed you to create this universe where the X-Men, we saw what the X-Men were fighting against in terms of prejudice and anxiety. And it gave Professor X sort of the room to breathe a little bit with his concern about, working together with humanity. And when Magneto comes in, you can make the argument he's not wrong.
We're about to get kicked out because, like I said, Zoom after 3 kicks us out after 40 minutes. I do apologize, but I do want to thank you guys a lot for talking with us. And I really want to talk about how important it was that the X-Men show was to my childhood. And I just want to appreciate it very much. Jaden, thank you so much for asking your questions as well. But sorry to interrupt. We'll be right back.